Hello and welcome to Eamon Talks, the affiliate marketing podcast. I'm Rob Davidson, content analyst in Awin's global strategy team, and I'm joined by my co-host Kevin Edwards, our global strategy director. Hi, Kev.
Hello.
And also Joelle Hillman, Awin UK's client partner for retail and travel. Hi, Joelle.
Hello.
How are you both doing? How was your respective Black Fridays?
Yeah, very good. Very nice weekend. I felt very festive this weekend. How about you guys?
I'm not quite into the Christmas festive spirit just yet.
Ever.
Despite the promotional ads already coming on all over the TV and everything. And despite the fact, actually, Joelle, that you're wearing a Christmas jumper.
Yeah, and my tree is up and my outdoor
it's
lights
a good
are
effort.
Up.
Well, I suppose we are recording this on December the 1st, so technically you're probably just about allowed to do that.
Thanks.
Well, we're also recording this, obviously, in the immediate afterglow of another frantic cyber weekend. And this year's edition, has been massively influenced by the various physical restrictions in place because of COVID-19. Now, e-commerce was already experiencing a boom thanks to those lockdown restrictions and the natural migration of shopping to online platforms and away from physical stores. With Black Friday occurring in the midst of a second COVID wave across many territories around the world, it was always likely to see a dramatic uplift. So we'll discuss some of Awin's findings on that front in just a moment. Elsewhere on the podcast this month, though, in our Meet the Market segment, I visited the US virtually, of course, and spoke to Michael Giacconi, CEO and co-founder of the mobile commerce platform Button, to find out what distinguishes the affiliate and digital marketing industries in America to elsewhere in the world. And it was also Joelle's misfortune this month to have to descend into Craig's data cave to ask him what his number of the month was. And something tells me it might well be Black Friday related too. So to steal some of Craig's thunder ahead of then, Kev, should we dive into some of the early insights that were gleaned from the weekend? And I guess, first of all, I just wanted to ask what the top line results were as far as Awin was concerned.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it's kind of no surprise really that numbers were up. They were pretty robust. I mean, November in general was really, really strong. Looking generally at our network, our global network, we tracked around almost 2.5 million transactions globally across the day, across all of the markets that we operate in, which is sort of quite a neat way of saying that we were able to do more than 100,000 transactions every hour. At peak, we were tracking around about 70 sales a second across the network, and thankfully everything held up, nothing creaked too much. So the tracking was robust and we recorded all of those sales. The numbers are sort of still coming through for the wider weekend, in that we kind of, when the data is updated on a daily basis, it sort of always adds a few extra sales into the pot, and we haven't really looked at Cyber Monday yet, but certainly Black Friday, we saw, I think, a sort of robust holding up of that year-on-year growth. Typically, we have noticed over the past few years, Black Friday sort of creeping earlier in the month. I think that the pandemic has kind of complicated that slightly, in that certainly in the UK, we've had shops closing. So that has inevitably forced people online. And I think there's been that sort of, people's minds have been focused on the fact that perhaps actually it's safer to do their shopping earlier. So we certainly did see a real uptick in sales in the sort of first week or so of November. But that trend has continued throughout the month. Like last year, some of the biggest monthly growth that we saw actually happened outside of Black Friday. So the weekend before Black Friday, we saw sort of sales easily sort of exceeding 50% year-on-year growth. That figure came down for Black Friday, was lower than that, but then that, as I say, is a trend that we've seen for the past couple of years as those promotional windows have been sort of pulled earlier and earlier, sort of pulling peak away from December into late November, and then Black Friday still remains by far and away the largest day, but we've certainly noticed some kind of other seasonal peaks happening across the broader month, making kind of November this whole sort of 30-day sort of promotional splurge.
I was just going to say, do you guys think that we'll see those discounts move into December this year because the stores are reopening tomorrow and the brands might want a chance for consumers to go into store and still bag those offers?
I mean, it's a really... we're kind of living times where it's really unknown kind of what's coming around the corner. And obviously changes to lockdown, we now feel like, from speaking from a UK perspective, it feels as though we sort of know what December's going to look like in terms of what we can and can't do. It wouldn't surprise me if people feel the need to actually go to the shops. I was out of the weekend, not shopping, but just meeting some friends near this sort of shopping centre. And even though the shops were closed, you could obviously still pick some stuff up, click and collect. And there were some restaurants open and it was still really, really busy. And I think that people still want to have that sort of physical connection. And now the shops are open, it wouldn't surprise me if people switch now from kind of an online shopping mode to an in-store shopping mode. And also, I think that we may have gone through that initial wave of people feeling panicked about whether they were going to get their products on time. But I think that that will probably sit at the back of people's minds, and that they feel, well, actually, if I do go to a store, then I can actually know that I can physically pick the product up. Obviously, news coming out of the UK around Debenhams and Arcadia as well, you know, two big shopping chains who it would appear at the time of recording that Debenhams is about to liquidate. It could be that, you know, if all the Arcadia shops stay open, then people want to go in store because they think they're probably going to be able to pick up bargains. We just don't know what the extent of discounting, excuse me, is going to be. Certainly IMRG, the UK Trade Association, have reported that more brands are in sale and have been in sale for longer and earlier than ever before. So I would expect that trend to continue into December, but how that will impact the volume of sales that we do online, I don't know. But I would expect December to be more muted. Certainly we saw December sales last year were 8% down on November sales. Order value revenue that we tracked was down by even more than that. And I think I would expect that trend to continue, especially because Cyber Monday happened in November this year, whereas it happened on December the 1st last year.
Yeah, I do wonder if, because obviously we come at this from the perspective of being a digital advertising business, and we often forget sometimes or neglect to think about the wider kind of, the wider retail industry maybe. And obviously the majority of that activity still takes place offline. It's a minority, even as much as it's increased and improved over the last, like year or so. It's still a minority proportion of that overall share. And I think Barclaycard, who in the UK track, I think through their card transactions, about one in every £3 that are spent across UK retailers. And they were suggesting that whilst there was a big increase and it hit a new record for online sales over the course of Black Friday, when you combine it with the physical transactions that were occurring in stores or not happening, as the case may be, it was down by about overall by about 16%, which obviously goes to show you kind of like the kind of, you know, the implications of all those stores being shut themselves.
Yeah. I think that marries up with some of the PwC predictions that came out just before Black Friday. So I think they'd run some surveys and said that 38% of the population in the UK were looking to shop on Black Friday. But actually that was down year on year. And in 2019, that was 51%. So quite a drop.
Yeah, you've got a lot of different factors, I think, that are being taken into account and are kind of compounding all of these sudden changes. And you have Prime Day, obviously, went much later than it ordinarily would have done during the summer. And that dragged a lot of interest, I think, not just from Amazon, but from other retailers piggybacking off of Prime Day, which is something we've seen over the last couple of years anyway. And like Kev mentioned, advertisers looking to expand the window of opportunity for shoppers to buy from them, largely partly, I think, to ensure that when the big day came, their kind of servers and their websites were able to deal with that sudden potential flurry of activity that would have historically occurred and maybe hampered their ability to sell things. And I know that from our perspective, we managed to kind of get through it pretty seamlessly, which was great to see. I didn't see any kind of incidents of publisher websites or advertiser websites going down or really kind of struggling with it too much.
No, I think there are some other things that we don't yet know, but having, you know, it's the event has literally just happened. So we haven't done a full set of number crunching, although there are some initial numbers, excuse me, on the website that you can find for how we performed across all markets. But there are going to be a number of different factors, I think. Like, for example, you know, people in the US were encouraged not to travel and not to see families, and a lot of people still did go and do that. But if people are in smaller groups, potentially people by themselves or in a couple, then, you know, if there's sort of activities that you wouldn't ordinarily have done that you're now no longer doing, does that kind of, you know, people kind of drift online? Does that encourage more shopping? Will we see that tipping point whereby Black Friday becomes the bigger day than Cyber Monday? You know, it's kind of been sort of nipping at the heels of Cyber Monday, Black Friday from an online perspective in the US. And it'll be interesting to see how those numbers play out.
Well, I know that Adobe were talking about the fact that on Thanksgiving, they hit a new record for digital sales. That was up by about over 21.5% year on year. And again, maybe that speaks to the fact that people, because they were isolating at home, they weren't able to come together with their families and friends to celebrate Thanksgiving in like the traditional sense, and whether you would have been kind of talking to people in the immediate kind of surroundings. Instead, you're, like you say, kind of dragged online. Maybe you're doing kind of virtual conference calls and video calls with your family, and it then kind of seamlessly segues into a bit of online shopping as well, because you're spending that time online.
That 21% almost directly correlates with the growth that we saw across the US market on Black Friday as well. Just talking kind of specifically about certain markets, I thought it was really interesting that the biggest growth that we saw was in the Nordics, but also not far behind were Spain and Italy. And Italy is one that we've sort of been following a little bit this year, because there have been a, sort of a number of different studies that come out that have talked about sort of Italy as this sort of huge country population wise from a European perspective, but actually quite small from an e-commerce and digital perspective. A lot of sort of opportunity that people see in that market. But I think there was a stat that I read recently that said that in the past, or up until the pandemic, so 2019, only 38% of Italians shopped at least one time a year online, and that's compared to about 76%, so like almost double effectively the number of people that shop online in the UK. We know that, you know, more than 2 million people shopped online in Italy for the first time this year, and I think it's interesting to see those sort of large markets but far fewer people shopping online, how potentially Black Friday has sort of created this, Black Friday has sort of manifested itself in this sort of new shopping behavior that's been adopted by a lot of people locally in those markets, and that may have therefore led to some of the kind of really high growth numbers that we saw across those markets on Black Friday.
Yeah, I thought it's really interesting. Particularly, I was reading something similar, I think, Kev, to the article that you mentioned there about Spain and the adoption that they've very gradually seen there historically. And they put it down partly anyway to the kind of logistical infrastructure not necessarily being there to actually deliver goods to kind of regions that are maybe slightly more kind of remote or mountainous, or slightly different landscapes and geography of that country compared to somewhere like the UK, which is necessarily that much more compact. It's maybe more cities where people are concentrated, and it's much easier to deliver those things logistically speaking. There's also, I noticed that, I don't know if this was the IMRG or another online resource, but they were talking about the phenomenon of Returns Thursday as well, which I think is really interesting. So this is to do with the notion of people buying things impulsively during Black Friday because of all the discounting that goes on, and then inevitably returning some of that stuff the following week. And so they've said that in recent years, around about 150% more items have been returned on the 3rd of December. That's sort of the specific date that they've called out, than any other date in the year, as shoppers obviously return these items that they bought kind of, and then, you know, they arrive, they're not happy with them, it's maybe the wrong size or whatever, and they're then sending it back. And that's a huge kind of cost for retailers from a logistical perspective as well. And they talked about the fact that this kind of reversal of cash flow can actually represent massive issues for retailers. Despite record sales on Black Friday in 2018, they said UK fashion retailers were hit with a £1.6 billion bill purely as a result of those post-Black Friday returns. So trying to make sure that the things that you're selling to shoppers actually fit them, that they're what they want, and that they're, you know, you're delivering goods that they, you know, that they're going to keep, is a huge kind of cost. If you don't get that right, I think.
Yeah, and a lot of those fashion retailers offer free returns as well, so that that's why it's probably inevitably more painful for those guys. But I suppose you can imagine a lot of those fashion brands, that is maybe a self-purchase rather than a gift, and maybe a bit of an impulse splurge rather than a considered purchase. So I can see why some of those products specifically are the ones that are starting to go back to the retailers the following week.
That self-gifting thing is an interesting thing, because I think that people have always associated Black Friday with buying gifts for others. But, you know, we did a survey quite a few years ago now, but I'd be surprised if it's changed that much, which said that actually half of people were shopping for themselves on Black Friday. And I can certainly avow, vouch for that from my own my own purchasing. Just a couple of other things that, Rob, I wanted to sort of just briefly mention. One thing, obviously, when we're measuring ourselves, we're measuring the whole network, everything that we track. So not just retail. Retail actually obviously dominated, as you would expect it. You know, we had the vast majority of our clients are our retail clients, but obviously travel numbers are in there. So that growth, overall growth that we've seen, was tempered somewhat by obviously a decline in travel. If you kind of was to strip that out, then obviously we saw more impressive growth when just kind of isolating the retail clients that we have. One other thing that we'll be looking at, that I'm really keen to look at over the coming weeks, is our clients where we track new and existing customers. So one of the most impressive set of stats that I saw actually was looking at how, it's a phenomenon that we've seen throughout the year, but, you know, the channel being really good at driving new customers in a way that historically it's been a much lower rate. And that always seems to spike around peak. So Black Friday is a really good way of attracting new customers. You know, I think there's lots of people that are just shopping, looking around, casual browsing. So it's a good way of being able to sort of snag new customers. But we certainly saw a really huge surge in the number of new customers that were coming through. And then when you start to segment that by affiliate type and affiliate activity, Cashback, who we know drive really good quality customers, but they don't necessarily drive high instances of new customers. They, you know, they've got a very loyal user base themselves. They actually increased the number of new customers by like a full 10 percentage points. And there were impressive growth as well from price comparison and editorial sites as well. So I think price comparison hit almost 50% new customers that were coming through sales from those types of activity. And, you know, this really feeds into that ongoing conversation that we have within affiliate marketing around delivering incremental value. And that's obviously a really good indicator of that. And the one other thing that I want to look at as well is, obviously there are brands every year who issue Black Friday. They choose not to get involved. And what's always interesting is when you look at their growth across the network, because they always see a bump. They always see sales increase, even if they are not in sale or promotion or are not doing anything Black Friday related. And again, I think it really taps into this sort of almost like feeding frenzy that there is online, and that people are just in buying mode and they are just looking around. And even if there isn't a discount or a deal, their mind is ready to buy. And so I think that can have a halo effect for brands, even if they aren't discounting or running promotions. So again, that's something that we know that some of our brands went with this year. So that will also be something that we'll be keen to look into the numbers for.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, obviously, you mentioning the fact that certain brands were deciding not to take part this year. From a consumer perspective, there was definitely, I think, like a growing surge of consumers that are choosing not to participate as well, for more ethical kind of environmental reasons. We've had like the Green Friday movement has been established, I think, for the last few years at least, where some groups have tried to raise environmental awareness by talking about more sustainable products that you can buy around Black Friday and alternative options in that respect. There was also Buy Nothing Day, which kind of did what it said on the tin, I think, which was essentially a protest against the whole rampant consumerism of Black Friday, which is obviously built over the years.
That's very difficult to measure online, though, when you aren't able to track it and track nothing.
Yeah, true. I don't think they're worried about quantifying the KPIs.
Results. Yeah.
But there was also a collaboration of various kind of prominent leaders, economists, writers, academics, etc., who were calling for shoppers to boycott Amazon specifically on Black Friday under the banner of this Make Amazon Pay. movement, and that was intended as the kind of start of a campaign against the retailers' record on things like workers' rights, environmental factors, tax avoidance, and even what activists are kind of suggesting is the kind of invasions of privacy via its growing range of internet connected devices as well. So this was seen as an opportunity to kind of raise some profile with regard to that initiative as well.
Yeah, I think there was a couple of AWIM brands that had some nice initiatives. So there was a couple that that you weren't able to purchase on their website on Black Friday specifically. I think that was a global beauty brand. There was a retailer as well that upped their prices, I think, by about £1, and that £1 went to charity on that day. So they again were a bit anti-discount. And I've looked in the UK specifically just on a sub-sector level in terms of what did really well in retail. And we have a category that we classify as our green or eco-friendly brands. And year on year, those brands were up 148% in terms of sales on Black Friday. AOV was up 48% year on year, and their conversion rate was up 364%. So people are really focused now on making sure that they're shopping in the right places.
That's really interesting to see. And I think it'll be fascinating to see how it evolves over the next few years. But if people want to read more about AWIN's Black Friday insights, Kev, you've penned an article this week, haven't you?
Yeah, it's very much sort of a first snapshot. It was sort of published on Cyber Monday morning, so looking at Friday's numbers and also some of the other trends from November. We'll obviously be looking at a kind of a more complete digest of everything, including Cyber Monday, later on in December.
And just a quick plug from me, the client partnerships team will also be running a Black Friday segment in the UK, the Pulse newsletter. That's likely to go out around the 8th or 9th of December.
You got your plug in.
Thanks. Hey, Craig.
Hey, how are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How was your Black Friday weekend?
Yes, it was good. It was good, thanks. Didn't do too much. And I'd spent all my money by the end of Friday, so I didn't spend too much either.
Nice. On Christmas gifting or yourself?
Myself.
Good effort.
Yeah, everything on myself this year.
What's your best purchase?
This is sad. I bought a sous vide, so I've been like, well, I just bought some kitchen equipment. Because one of my passions is cooking, so I bought a sous vide in honour of like MasterChef professionals that I watch. So.
Yeah. Cool. So what is your number of the month?
The number of the month this month is 8, and that's for 8 p.m. when we hit our 2 million transaction on Black Friday.
Strong. And when, how does that compare to our performance versus last year?
Yeah, so we didn't hit 2 million until around like 10:30, 11 o'clock last year. And that's it, well, UTC time.
Yeah.
Based on the global network numbers.
Yeah, so that, sorry, that those times that you're referencing, the 8 p.m. for this year, is the same time frame across every territory in AWIM.
Yeah. So it's based on the advertiser's preferred time zone. But because the majority of are kind of like, you know, in Eastern time zones, it kind of weights towards UTC. So we'll just, so it's 8 p.m. UTC based on that.
And I know, I suppose the question people are probably asking is, I wonder if we hit that 2 million target earlier this year because volumes were higher online or because performance was different by the hour?
Yeah, so actually, like, for the most part, performance was the same by the hour. We see like that kind of elephant shape in the line graph where we get like a spike at midnight. It kind of decreases. Now, we actually saw less sales by 6 a.m. this year. So we'd actually made less sales by that point, but then we saw it hugely ramp up in the morning. And I don't know if that's a general trend or whether that's because people are working from home. We also saw a bit of a spike at 5 p.m., which I think you could put down to people working from home across Europe, because effectively, you know, normally commuter times and things like that would have an effect on sales. I think when we see the more detailed analysis on kind of devices and stuff like that, we'd be able to make more assumptions on that. I think for now, like, that's what my assumption would be, is that the fact that people have been working from home, people purchase at different times. As I say, it's roughly the same. But yeah, 5 p.m. was a bit of a spike as well.
Yeah, I think Alex Palmier covered that earlier this year in one of the coronavirus webinars that we covered. And actually, he saw a similar trend in that pre-6 a.m. Time frame and like the post 5:30 to like 10 p.m. working time frames, we were seeing less sales now that people weren't commuting and were working from home, and in fact it was more spread out across the day. I suppose their bosses weren't looking at their desktops, so they could do a bit of browsing throughout the working hours.
I know, that's it, isn't it? I suppose there would be there is an element to that.
And have you got any more trends for us, I suppose, based on the wider Cyber Week?
Yeah. So Cyber Week, we don't have Cyber Monday numbers just yet. They'll probably come out later today. So as a time of recording, we don't really have those numbers. But we can say from Monday to Sunday versus last year, we have, in terms of exact increases, the network saw a 17% increase in sales and a 5% increase in commission. Like for like sales, however, so looking at advertisers that were live then and advertisers that are live now, which I suppose for kind of the general public would be more interesting because that's an indication of the industry at large. We saw a 25% increase in sales and a 14% increase in commission overall. So it's still, the story is the same in that people are, the advertisers are paying less per sale, but there was a general increase in both. AOV dropped by about €8 per sale.
Interesting. Do you think that's because there was better deals out there, or do you think consumers were unable to spend as much as they usually did per purchase?
I'm not too sure on the deal side of things. I think that, yes, it would be, logic would dictate that it would be that there would be less, there's less for people to spend. You know, all of this is in kind of respect of the coronavirus and the way that's hitting economies. Now, the global economy is set to shrink about 5% this year, which is its biggest global recession in 50 odd years, I think, like decades and decades. So it's huge in terms of contraction. So actually, when we look at the figures, they're actually quite positive. Even though commission, so they're actually doubly positive because of the fact that there is that. Now, we're talking about more people shopping online. There's less choice to go out and shop in the high street because of lockdown measures. But actually, as well, we've still seen an increase in kind of general sales more than what we'd expect, judging by the global economy. And that goes as well for the AOV as well, back to your point on that. Like, we would see a decrease because we, you know, people are going to be spending generally less.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I suppose it's really tricky to have a look at those year-on-year comparisons this year because there are so many different factors from everything from job losses to high street closures that really changes that landscape for us this year.
It comes into the commission element of it as well. So, you know, obviously we're looking at commission based on revenue for the majority of advertisers. And so that's going to have a direct effect on how much commission is paid out as well. So that's another reason that commission has decreased. It's not necessarily that advertisers' CPAs generally have come down. It's a mixture of the two, I would imagine. Constrained budgets would force a lot of our retailers to pay less per sale. But also as well, you would have, you know, order value would have a direct effect on that commission as well.
Awesome. Interesting. Thank you so much for that, Craig. I'll let you get back to enjoying your cooking and your new CV.
Thank you.
In our latest edition of Meet the Market, we're finding out more about the market where it all began as far as performance marketing and the vast majority of digital advertising is concerned. It's the US. And to do so, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Michael Ciccone, CEO and co-founder of the mobile commerce platform Button. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good, Robert. Thanks so much for having me today. Appreciate it and excited to talk to you and talk about what we're seeing here.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you made it on. So I wanted to kick off, as I always do, with the Meet the Market segment and just ask you a little bit about what you think distinguishes the US digital advertising industry from other regions around the world.
Yeah, so I think, you know, what we're seeing in the US and what the rest of the world's also dealing with is how we're responding to the pandemic. What we have expected and what's been validated in the recent passage through the holidays is that, you know, in-store spending is down, online spending is up. You know, as a result, the advancements and steps that we're making in digital advertising are going to really accelerate how much marketers are spending in their digital channels, trying to understand that, you know, all of the investments that they're making that used to allocate total marketing budgets to the in-store and digital pieces of where that investment went are going to shift more and more to digital in this new reality. And so I think you've seen an acceleration take place where, you know, the U.S., which is, you know, arguably been hit the hardest of any of the countries due to the pandemic, we're seeing more and more foot traffic declines and more online traffic increases. And so I think that's, you know, bodes well for many companies that focus on digital advertising. And I also think, you know, what you see with the recent holiday spend is that the acceleration of adoption of not only desktop, you know, purchasing, but mobile purchases is going to continue to be a really big part of our near-term future and how we should be planning our businesses.
Yeah, I think we're recording this obviously in the immediate aftermath of the Cyber Weekend, and Cyber Monday, I think, has gone down as pretty much the biggest online shopping event in the US history, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. I think the estimate is almost $11 billion was generated on Cyber Monday, which is the biggest day in you know, U.S. e-commerce history. And so I think, you know, this is a combination of factors contributing to that. But what ultimately the pandemic will do that I think is a positive for many companies in the e-commerce space is it's forced adoption. And that forced adoption is going to allow new things to emerge with far more rapid timelines than anybody anticipated before. Online grocery, which was forecasted to be the largest area of e-commerce growth over the coming 5 years, never anticipated the growth that it's seeing today. And so you get to see, you know, that emerge. And I think we'll have a number of businesses that see benefit from this, but also a number of new businesses started in the wake of the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating to see how things are going to evolve there. I wanted to ask you specifically about the affiliate channel and the performance industry of the US and what the general perception you feel of advertisers and brands in the US of that industry is right now.
Yeah, I think that affiliate, which has been one of the oldest and most tested, tried methods of marketing since the digital era and the advent in the late 90s, you really have seen two things emerge. One, every big retailer brand invests in affiliate marketing. And you don't talk about it a lot because the company is so private, but Amazon has relied on affiliate as a core and really primary marketing strategy for them and for their acquisition strategies. When you look at the importance of performance and affiliate marketing in the lens of a company as sophisticated as Amazon, you marvel at how certain elements of this marketing channel have not evolved or not changed. And I think that's fundamentally where this industry has been stuck. It has so much promise, it has so much potential, but there is so much structure that is really hard to break down that you ultimately you haven't seen a wave of innovation come in respect to what marketers' capabilities are in this category. And part of that is old infrastructure that's still thriving and, you know, good enough. Part of that is a majority of this industry, like it or not, is run by loyalty properties, loyalty sites and coupon and cashback sites. And for those two reasons, the older infrastructure and the kind of homogenous, you know, loyalty-oriented sites that dominate the category, it makes it really hard for the marketers at these big brands to justify investment in new technologies, justify taking a leap of faith on something new, because what they have is profitable. It may not be the most sophisticated, it may not be the smartest, but they know that they can continue to plug in the same amount of budget and receive the same amount of traffic and profitability. And when you compare that to the profitability challenges and the competition that's inherent in the spending and platforms like social and in search, it's a totally different dynamic. And so where, you know, affiliate marketing often, you know, falls down but is still propelled is that it's a profitable channel. Doesn't take much investment, doesn't take a ton of effort, and it will continue to run. And that's how most senior marketer CMOs talk about it when I talk to them about it. What I think is a promising element is that this channel in 20 years hasn't had much innovation in terms of what marketers can do with it. And that's starting, I think, to change. I think people are finally saying, hey, it's 2020. We've got to make this thing work better. Because if I could extract more value out of this channel that is so highly profitable, I could really change how my business performed. And so I think that's something that, you know, we haven't seen a ton of in the past, but I'm an eternal optimist. And I believe the pandemic, although it has crushed many businesses, I think that there will be some silver lining in that CMOs and CEOs are going to say, hey, what are my profitable channels of acquisition? What are my channels of conversion-based marketing that I can actually double down on because they're profitable? Because today, Facebook, today, Google, I don't yield a ton of profit. Yeah, I get a lot of volume, but I don't get a ton of profit from them. And so I expect that to emerge as a catalyst for change, and I hope it will.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, actually, my next question was going to be about what you think the biggest challenges are for the industry in the US. And I guess it is almost that mindset one and perception of what you can actually do with affiliates, and that it's not just a one-dimensional model, that there's actually a lot more scope for exploration in terms of new e-commerce technology and opportunities there.
Yeah, I think so. I think part of it is, you know, I see this a lot where, you know, the opportunities in this channel often are defined by, you know, a marketer who's distant from affiliate will often say, hey, affiliate's a channel that, you know, we can't invest a ton in. And so that's a perception issue. Where that comes to the rubber meeting the road is where you need developers to invest and integrate. And what a kind of unknown secret, when you study a lot of the platforms that are affiliate platforms, a lot of them, many of them don't have a lot of great technology. And that's a challenge. I think Awin is really powerful in that it has great technology. But what you find is that a lot of these things, because the marketing channel of affiliate can't get investment of engineering resources, people stitch together all this myriad of different technology to make things work for them. And that's problematic because, A, it means the technology is just kind of a house of cards. But also what I think is challenging is that it's indicating something bigger, which is that the marketers aren't giving the resources because they don't feel they need to. And that means that the value propositions presented to them have not been strong enough, have not been meaningful enough, or the marketer in that position isn't looking to optimize or improve. They're looking to just keep it going, keep it running as is. And so I think that's a fundamental problem. And now I'm a startup. I still consider myself a startup, and we've been trying like crazy to get integrated, you know, with our technology deeply into the largest retailers in the world, and we've succeeded in many places where the mandate from the CEO or CMO is optimize, yield much more revenue per tap than we could otherwise, personalize, spend in the same level. With the same level of sophistication that we've spent in Google and in Facebook in this channel. And that's where our success has been born. But it is not easy. And it is especially difficult when you come into the category through or into the company through the affiliate marketer, because the affiliate marketer often isn't given the dev resources to integrate or use engineering resources to do a lot. And so that's a challenge that companies have to face and sweeten their value propositions to make sure that companies will, you know, marketers will take the bet, take the jump.
Yeah. Now, talking of challenges, I know you already referenced coronavirus and some of the impact that it's already had out in the US market. I wondered whether or not you thought that the shopping habits that have rapidly increased out in the US, do you think that this is a permanent increase that we're going to see? Or do you think as maybe vaccines are developed, as some sense of normalcy begins to be established next year, potentially, that we start to see that kind of drag down back to similar levels that I guess we saw before the pandemic and the subsequent lockdowns?
It's a great question. I think that the tail of the pandemic's impact on business is going to be felt more prominently in the travel sector. I believe that what you're going to see is that most times, once you become an online shopper and you recognize the convenience that it provides, not having to drive to a store, not having to carry, not having to deal with the parking spot, and all of the associated stress, and the fact that, like, time is a finite resource. Warren Buffett and Robert Davidson have the same amount of time in their days.
That's all that we have in common.
That's about it. But that's fine. But in reality, giving you 3 hours back so that you can click buy, I think is something that I would bet a lot of people, when introduced to the ease, to the convenience, to the fact that in many cases, these people that are adopting haven't adopted because they were still scared about putting their credit card into something online. That's a real truth. That's when you look at data on why people don't shop online, that's a big contributor. And so once they, I think, cross that chasm, I don't think they're coming back. And sure, everyone's going to still go to a store when they have to or they need something urgently until Bezos fixes that. But, you know, before drones are dropping off toilet paper in emergency scenarios, I think that you're going to see this shift be a lasting one. And so I expect that to be a change where you don't, when the vaccine comes out, when people can go back into stores, I think that'll happen. But I think that the new low watermark is being set.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And there's some of the trends that we've been tracking at Awin across a sector level. It was interesting talking to one of our retail experts who was explaining how luxury has really taken off in a big way over the course of the lockdown, which was always one of those subsectors, you know, luxury fashion, luxury healthcare or beauty. It was always one of those sectors that didn't translate necessarily quite as well on online because there was the whole experiential aspect of that when you went into stores and you tried stuff on, you had support of the kind of the staff there as well. And that aspect was never replicable online. And what I think the lockdown has shown is actually people were quite happy to still commit to buying those things, even though they're much higher basket values, they're willing to commit. They don't have maybe the issues and anxieties that they might have had previously. And that's something that has kind of opened up a new seam of opportunity that didn't exist before. I wanted to ask you quickly, just before we kind of round things off, in terms of innovation, both from publisher perspectives, from brand perspectives, what kinds of things have you been seeing in the affiliate channel that have kind of caught your interest, would you say, in the US over the last few months?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I often come back to is I think about what businesses will be successful, what have been successful in the past. And a lot of times, you know, people believe that there's going to be this brand new invention, like everybody gets really excited when the next Pinterest, you know, clone comes out, Pinterest for shopping. And every one of those businesses, unfortunately, I've seen, and I looked at investing in or buying into my former role, they all ultimately fail in some way, shape or form because no one can be Pinterest and Pinterest is the greatest. So a lot of times you're like, all right, what could actually emerge that could be successful? And where I am seeing the most promise in this category is with more of the same, but in a new incarnation. And what I mean by that is the publishers that have become the biggest, that represent truly 70-ish percent of all traffic and affiliate, are loyalty-oriented properties, whether it's saving people money, helping them fund their bank accounts, helping them earn cash back, the kind of negative word no one wants to use, but earning points, whatever it is, that proposition makes sense. Now, that's not crazy because if you look at every one of the largest marketing companies, these giant credit card and bank businesses, what is the proposition they're hammering consumers with every day? Capital One, it's Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta talking about their rewards card, right? And everybody is talking about why you should use your Mileage Plus card, your cash back card, your XYZ. So that proposition is the most widely marketed proposition that we as consumers see when we're talking about financial services and we're talking about e-commerce or shopping benefits. So loyalty as a value proposition is not new. It is used pervasively across industries. And where it is emerging relevant to affiliate is that you're seeing this wave of fintech businesses from the Affirms and the Klarnas to the neobanks like Acorns or Monzo, all coming online and saying, hey, when I look at Bank of America and Chase and Wells Fargo, all these companies have a core commerce strategy embedded into them. And where all these companies are coming in and saying, we're digital first businesses. We want to create a e-commerce experience for our consumers to shop and to earn rewards and to remember to use our fintech service, top of wallet, or be the first choice for them when ultimately they're making decisions. You see it echoed by PayPal's acquisition of Honey for $4 billion. You're seeing it with companies like Rakuten acquiring Ebates or Square launching the Cash App with a ton of shopping features built into it. So I think that the exciting element for me is that loyalty has proven to be a successful marketing tactic. It is successful in affiliate. It represents 70% of the traffic here. And now there's this wave of new and emerging companies in that category that are coming out. And that is the neobanks and the new fintech companies. And so I think that's where you'll see, it doesn't take a ton of imagination to see how those will be successful.
Interesting. Okay, so final question. I always finish our Meet the Market segments like this, and this is always the most complicated one, I think, for you to answer. But how would you sum up everything that entails the US affiliate industry in just three words?
I think that the commerce revolution has begun.
Well, that's a great way to sum everything up there. So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast this month, Michael, and hopefully we'll get a chance to speak to you again at some point in the future. And we wish you the best of luck in 2021.
Awesome. Robert, thank you so much. I think your questions are always so thoughtful, and it's awesome to be with you and the A1 team always. Thanks, guys.
Thanks to Craig and Michael for their insights on today's pod. And in fact, speaking of Button, we've recently published some early mobile insights that have been tracked off the back of Awin's partnership with Button's Reach solution. We'll put a link in the show notes to an interview with Button's head of partnerships, Dennis O'Reilly, that shed some light on the early successes that partnership is already demonstrating in helping advertisers effectively track mobile activity. Now, last month's podcast, we were recording just before PI Live, the annual performance industry conference, was being held with Awin delivering a whole day's worth of sessions. Don't worry if you missed it, though, because all of our sessions were recorded and are now available to watch online at the Awin site, and I'll include a link to those in the notes as well. Now, November is award season in the performance industry, and I'm pleased to share news of some Awin successes this month, which included, first of all, a win at the DigiDay Technology Awards, where we picked up Best Affiliate Platform recently. I think it's always really enjoyable to win awards that sit outside of your own immediate industry, and that was a great example of that. But having said that, we can't not mention the great night that we had at the International Performance Marketing Awards as well, where we picked up a record 6 wins in total. We won for individual campaigns with the likes of Etsy, mobiles.co.uk, Nike. I need to get that right. And also Taste Card as well. And we also won the much coveted Best Team Award for our Awin Access team's work this year in supporting small businesses, along with the Best Network Award, which was particularly sweet, as that's the first time that we've won that award at a global level. You guys were both tuning in to the Eurovision style event that I was co-hosting. What did you make of the awards this year?
I mean, considering it was virtual and we had you and APY instead of a room of thousands of people and a beautiful 3-course dinner and some vino, I had a great evening.
Not having any wine on the go. It was quite early in the day, really, though, wasn't it?
It was really early, and I think I was already hungover before the end of the event, so
all that excitement got to your head.
Exactly, yeah.
But I think it was really important for us as a business to hold that virtual event and just make sure that we tuned in together and we celebrated our success together.
Yeah, definitely. Those last two awards were partially voted for by the industry, so thanks to any listeners that voted for us. And if you didn't, well, hopefully we'll earn your vote in next year's edition instead. But yeah, there's a roundup available of that event as well on the Awin site if you want to find out more about each of those wins. Joelle, from your perspective, what's in the offing from a content side of things?
Yeah, so we've been doing a bit of a focus on the health and beauty sector, actually. So, I mean, health and beauty is one of our largest sectors within retail generally. It's actually the largest in terms of the number of advertisers in the UK that we have in that subsector. But we've obviously seen performance boom this year in health and beauty. And actually, some of the trends have been really interesting. So we've decided to run a bit of a 3-piece showcase specifically focused on that sector. The first one was released last week, so that's already live on our Awin website, but that covers everything from the new customer versus existing customer trends we've seen across health and beauty, the D2C trend, because obviously stores are shutting and some brands are needing to get closer to their customers and they're using online as a route to do that, and also the publisher makeup across health and beauty. And there was a third story that I've definitely forgotten. Oh, luxury and everyday. So this was actually a really interesting story because despite the fact that we've been inside for the majority of the year and budgets for the most part have been tight, we have actually seen luxury beauty outperform everyday beauty in terms of year-on-year performance. A little bit like in the recession when we have the lipstick effect. People really want to treat themselves and make sure they're looking after themselves. So we're really starting to see that trend emerge. That was this week's segment. And then coming up, we'll have a couple of case studies from brands and a publisher interview in the sector as well.
It's interesting. I was just going to say that that lipstick effect. I was there's an article on The Gross, which I'll send over to you, which talks a bit. It's actually from a couple of months ago. And he talks about this guy that's written it. He talks about there was a £36 lipstick that sold out in the UK and the US in 8 seconds. In September, so that very much feeds into that sort of lipstick effect during the recession, which I'll send over to you.
Yeah. Is that like, because what is the average price of lipstick? I have no idea.
Come on, Rob, why don't you know?
That's not, I mean, that's the upper end, but it's not too outrageous.
Oh, yeah.
But I've definitely seen beauty sell out really quickly this year, so I mean, Kylie Jenner, obviously her range goes quickly, but she did like a Grinch collection this season, which I really wanted to purchase for my teenage cousin, and it ran out literally immediately.
I think it's really interesting, the luxury angle and how that seems to be growing, like you said, despite the fact that we're in, you know, a recession largely. And the fact that I know that for years and years, there was a lot of maybe anxiety, a lot of dilemmas around how luxury was going to necessarily migrate online. How were people going to commit to purchasing those items online, removed from the experience of the store? Did they have the confidence in doing that? And did they have the interest, you know, from an experiential perspective to kind of actually want to purchase something that is more of a, you tend to kind of associate it with the luxury stores and the high end kind of experience of it. You don't necessarily get that so much in an online experience. So it's interesting to see that a huge amount of growth there.
But I think that that really taps into this whole D2C phenomenon now, doesn't it? In that by offering products as a D2C brand, you know, rather than like concessions in stores, etc., you're able to take control of that entire customer experience and know everything about your customer because you're speaking to them directly. And I think that that's obviously really, really important for luxury brands. You know, personalization, being able to speak, know the person, speak, certainly people that are spending thousands and thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands or even more with you every year, being able to have those personalized conversations for those brands is really important.
Yeah, I think something that's really tricky in beauty is like color matching specifically. And you can definitely see that the content has shifted online in terms of beauty and people are really focused on aiding customers online with that experience because they can't start to test those products out themselves in store. Something that's a really nice piece of technology is increasingly they're working with a beauty brand on their increasing your basket spend. And actually that user journey is really nice because you'll go on to one of the beauty brands who's using that technology and you'll put a foundation in your basket and it will suggest the brush that matches that foundation or the blusher that matches that foundation. So it really helps you understand what you need for your full makeup bag, which for somebody like me is very easy to get carried away.
I think that also the kind of rise of D2C that you mentioned as well obviously speaks to the success that Shopify have had over the last few years. They've been the kind of poster child for that rising phenomenon of D2C brands taking their stuff online and connecting with customers in a new way. And we should also just note here that Awin's very recently launched its own e-commerce plugin for Shopify, making it actually the very first global affiliate network to launch in their app store and open up access for Shopify retailers to the hundreds of thousands of different Awin publisher partners across the globe. So we're hoping to have a bit more of a dedicated discussion on that partnership with Shopify and on that wider topic on the podcast very soon. So do look out for that episode in the near future. But for now, That's probably all that we've got time for in today's episode. So thanks for listening in, and we'll hopefully see you again very soon. It's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Joelle.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from Kev.
Bye.